Last year was another record-breaking year for the Global Heat Index. 2012 was among the 10th warmest years on record, the hottest on record in the United States, according to the State of the Climate Report that was just released by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Hotter temperatures, melting ice. How is 2013 looking up? Descartes is one of the editors of this report and chief of the Climate Monitoring Branch at NOAA in Asheville, North Carolina. He joins us from WCQS. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Does one thing stand out? Is there a blip or that really pops out in 2012 climate?
I think it's a mix of two things. We saw generally broadly across the many indicators that we looked at that the warming and the changing going on with our climate system continues, you know, and that's looking at the oceans or the ice sheets or the glaciers or the snow cover. We saw, you know, broadly a continuation of recent trends in that regard. And then also the Arctic as a region, not just the Arctic Sea, but all around the Arctic, land, air, sea ecosystem, huge changes, huge and what we call anomalies in 2012 across the Arctic.
Wow. Would that be Greenland also and melting glaciers there?
The Greenland ice sheet saw some record loss at times during the year itself, and then again, it tends to almost every year lose more and more ice. So the mass, the actual quantity of ice sitting atop Greenland, down once again this year.
Mm-hmm. And there's sort of a feedback loop there, isn't there, with the ice and the melting ice in the Arctic, and then the exposure of the sunlight to the ocean.
That's correct. You know, we often don't think about how important the Arctic is as part of our climate system, but it is a region that is covered in white stuff throughout most of the year. And when that white stuff goes away, what it does, the snow and the ice that covers the Arctic tends to reflect the incoming sunlight right back out into space. And as that disappears, as that retreats, as the footprint of the white stuff, the frozen stuff, snow and ice goes away, more and more sunlight is absorbed in the Arctic. And so that is what we would call a positive feedback, or what folks might call a vicious cycle. That tends to add to the warming of the planet. So it's an important region, even though it's many hundreds and thousands of miles away.
Mm-hmm. It appears, though, that that while the Arctic is melting, there may be something the opposite actually happening in the Antarctic.
Yes, the Antarctic, in 2012 anyway, saw growth to record levels. So when the Antarctic sea ice reached its maximum at the end of its winter, which is September, that was larger than it had been in the previous 35 years or so. What we do see in the Antarctic is continued growth and retreat. Almost every year, it expands rapidly and contracts almost all the way back to the Antarctic continent, whereas in the Arctic, we tend to see permanent multi-year sea ice. So when we lose ice in the Arctic, it tends to be indicative and have longer-term consequences than what we see in the Antarctic.
Does that mean that global warming is not happening, seeing the snow, the ice building in the Antarctic?
Well, again, that is more of an annual cycle, and each year kind of in the Antarctic is reborn. And so it's a little bit more independent of the years before it. We're actually seeing some thinning of the ice across the land in the Antarctic as well. So no, really multiple indicators when you look worldwide, especially in the Arctic, where multi-year ice is important, and multi-year ice that survives this expansion and contraction cycle is an important element and very sensitive to the long-term climate signal. We're seeing multiple indicators that the planet continues to change, and all of these indicators are at least pointed in the direction of a warming world. Most of them are pointed strongly in the direction of a warming world, and those that aren't are just we're relatively neutral for the last few years.
Mm. Let's talk about some of those warming events. It's the summer. The summer was really hot and drought filled in lots of places in the U.S.
So we saw that across the U.S. beginning really in the spring months and extending into summer, and we had our warmest year on record here in the U.S. Even though it is roughly a top 10 year for the globe, the U.S. had its warmest year, so we were part of the driving of that warmth. And we saw a large drought kind of manifest during the summer months across the plains, and that has since migrated into the western half of the country. But yes, yeah, so we in many ways led the world in a very warm year for the United States.
Well, the Russians weren't far behind. They had a big drought too, did they not?
Yeah, that's one thing. You know, it's nice to look at these broad indicators, and it's great these indicators and data sets and editors even come from all over the world to help put this together. So it's a real privilege to work with all of those folks. And one of the things that we really had noticed emerging as a theme was drought in the Northern Hemisphere, particularly in agricultural areas of the Northern Hemisphere. So 2012 by itself will be known as a year of drought, not just in the U.S. grain-producing areas, but we saw that in much of Asia and Eastern Europe as well.
Mm. Were there any areas where things actually improved, anything that's going on with the climate?
Well, one way, you know, as part of the atmospheric system, we do continue to see reductions in ozone-depleting gases. So if you remember all the way back to the 80s when chlorofluorocarbons were an issue, we do see, if not major improvements, at least a stabilization of those gases as well. And then in general, this isn't necessarily indicative of an improving climate, but when you bring all of these indicators together, one real positive that you get out of it is by having multiple authors looking at multiple data sets, looking at multiple parts of the climate system, it really helps us refine our precision. So we are able to be more confident that we are precisely measuring what we think we're measuring. And that's one of the purposes of this report.
Yeah. I'd like to bring on another guest who says increases in temperature may also lead to increases in violence and human conflict. You know, we all know that feeling when you're sweating in a hot, crowded place. You get a little antsy. Can a warming climate affect our social behavior? Sol Shung is assistant professor at the University of California in Berkeley. He's here in our New York studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about your study. It seems like it's common sense. Things get hotter, people get hot under the collar. What does your study show?
So what we did is we actually looked at 60 previous studies conducted by over 190 authors around the world. And we tried to understand, were there any common patterns in the results that these researchers were finding? And what we found is that whether you look around, wherever you look at around the world, whenever you look at human history, changes in the climate have been associated with changes in human conflict from sort of the interpersonal level, conflicts between individuals, things like domestic violence or road rage on the ground, to the group level, things like interethnic riots and civil conflicts.
And you can actually put numbers and figures on the increases in these things?
Yeah, so that was the central contribution of this study, was to try and – it was actually a meta-analysis where we took a lot of previous statistical results and we tried to combine them to get sort of more solid numbers that we could really get behind. Mm-hmm. And so what we found was that for a one standard deviation change in the climate, and that's just sort of a yardstick that we use, we observe a 4% increase in interpersonal conflict and a 14% increase in intergroup conflict, sort of as median estimates from around the world.
14%?
Yes.
Wow.
So that's one reason.
Is that surprising to you? Is it sounding as it is sounding to me?
Yes. We were struck by both the level of consistency across different studies as well as the overall magnitude of these results. So the central contribution of the paper is to point out that the overall sensitivity of human societies is substantially larger than I think most people would intuitively think.
Hmm. Just for the geeks in the room, how many degrees is one standard deviation here?
So the reason we used standard deviations is because different studies look at different locations, and changes in the climate historically look very different depending on where you are. If you're in a United States county, then a one standard deviation change in temperature is roughly 5 degrees increase in Fahrenheit. Mm-hmm. So it's a relatively small change, but it still leads to a pretty substantial change in human behavior.
Has anybody really studied, you know, what happens under a laboratory controlled condition? You get people hot?
You know? Yes.
Yeah?
So two of the studies we looked at were actual experiments. I can tell you about them if you're interested.
Yeah, please.
So one was actually kind of a famous study where they actually looked at – they messed with drivers on the ground to see basically how angry they could get them. And they basically applied the same treatment to all the different drivers. They put a car in front of a green stoplight and let a car come up behind them. And then they just didn't budge during the green light. And a guy, one of the researchers in the bushes, basically timed how much time they spent on the horn during the 12-second green light cycle. And what you saw was that on hotter days, it was a dramatically higher level of aggression towards the driver in front of you. There's a different study that was actually conducted in a laboratory, as you suggest,
right,
where they actually did police training exercises in front of basically a monitor and changed the temperature in the room and observed that when faced with an assailant, police officers were more likely to use an aggressive stance or to draw or fire their weapon when they were under hotter conditions. Hmm. But that's a scenario where they were both the police officers in the hot room and the cold room were faced with exactly the same stimulus in terms of what the assailant looked like and what their actions were.
Yeah, well, you know, if the climate is warming and people are going to be exposed to hotter situations and there's going to be more people sweating and hot under the collar, doesn't this mean we need more training or to need to realize the potential for violence here?
Absolutely. We think that by sort of studying these issues and highlighting where they emerge, we can sort of develop either policies or institutions or way to adapt to these types of environmental fluctuations so that this doesn't happen as frequently in the future, especially as the world, and this only becomes increasingly important as the world seems to be getting warmer.
Mm-hmm. And I guess if the climate is shifting and jobs may be shifting with the movement of the climate, people are getting angrier.
Exactly. And so when we look at these sorts of larger scale conflicts, things like civil conflict, which is a very complicated event, obviously it's not only dependent on the climate. It's dependent on many factors. But one of the important factors is the state of the economy and what people are doing on a day-to-day basis. And what we're learning is that as climatic changes occur, they are having important impacts on various economic sectors. And so in places where employment might go up, people have fewer things to do. It's easier to get them irritated, get them involved in a riot or in organized violence.
Adika, you folks at NOAA, do you realize this connection?
Well, it's great to listen in because one of the things that we do here in Asheville at the National Climatic Data Center is preserve all of the data that is used in studies to help define what is one standard deviation from place to place. So we see we do get the privilege of seeing many, many uses of long-term climate data and weather data, and it's fascinating and it's really neat to help support in a small way this great research that's helping make the country smarter.
Mm-hmm. This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Deke Arndt and Saul Shung talking about the changes in the climate from 2012. One of the things, Deke, that has been predicted from the loss of the glaciers and the fact that the glaciers are melting and spewing huge amounts of ice-cold water into the oceans is that they may change the patterns of ocean circulation. Has there been any evidence of that yet?
Well, currents in the ocean, the oceans generally, as you mentioned, are dynamic things, and so they're sensitive to changes in their overall environment, much like the weather that we experience here on land is sensitive to changes in the overall climate. So there's been a great deal of research into if we do lay a lot of this cold, fresh water on top of certain parts of the, particularly the North Atlantic, how will that change the Gulf Stream and the larger global ocean circulation pattern that delivers much of the climate that we know and especially that Northern Europe knows. And while the results aren't totally conclusive, it's an active area of research. I think it's safe to say we will see changes, and it's quantifying those changes and the time scales and the magnitude of those changes that a lot of really smart folks are looking at.
Mm-hmm. Where do you go from here? Where do, in terms of climate and violence research, what more stuff can you, Saul, look into? What do you want to look at next?
Well, what we try to communicate is that we can observe a really strong association between climatic conditions and how different populations behave. Mm-hmm. But in many cases, it's extremely difficult to understand exactly why. What is the mechanism that translates changes in the climate into changes in human behavior? Mm-hmm. And so in that sort of sense, we're kind of like where epidemiological researchers were in the 1930s that looked at smoking and could find there was a clear association between smoking tobacco and lung cancer,
right.
But they couldn't explain why. So moving forward, a lot of the research community is going to try to understand what are the different mechanisms. Is it something economic, as mm-hmm. you suggested? Is it something psychological, as the psychologists have been suggesting? And in reality, it's probably a combination of many factors, and those factors might be different. So trying to understand when one thing is important and a different mechanism is important in a different context is going to be the key to designing interventions that are effective.
Yeah, so that implies that there may be certain parts of the world that are more dangerous or more threatened by the climate change, the heat from civil conflict than other parts.
Absolutely. So we think that sort of your geography might be important. Things like international trade tend to be important, whether or not you can effectively move food in and out of your country. Mm. And then, you know, and Deke will know this better than I do, but there's many parts of the world that are expected to warm much more substantially than others. Yeah. And so there we should expect to see a larger impact.
Deke, we're now past half the year in 2013. Any predictions on how we're doing this year?
Well, globally, we expect 2013 to not be too different from 2012. Many of the large-scale factors that tend to push the global temperature up and down from year to year, like the presence of El Nino or La Nina, look a lot like 2012. So while it's not a sure thing, we're looking at something close to a top 10 finish for global temperatures. We have seen the drought in the United States migrate westward. So, and western water issues are a lot different in the U.S. than eastern water, water issues. So they're worried about snow and reservoirs, where in the plains where I'm from, you worry about tomorrow's thunderstorms. So that is an important factor that we're keeping track of. We're monitoring here at NCDC and at many places around the country. As far as the temperature, I don't know when the next time we'll see a year in the United States as warm as 2012. It not only broke the record, it just obliterated it. So it set a new bar very high temperature-wise.
Do you have to add another color like the Australians had to?
We actually did have to adjust our national temperature graph that we had been displaying.
What color is that?
Well, we just added a new number to the top. So where there was a 54, we added a 55.
Wow.
We broke the old record by about a whole degree, which in the long term, look at a national temperature, that's a big number. May not sound like much to you and me, but you smear 1 degree Fahrenheit across the whole country, and it's a big deal.
There's the point of the day. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for taking time to talk with us today. Deke Arnn is the editor of this report and chief of the Climate Monitoring Branch at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Asheville, North Carolina. Sol Shong, assistant professor, University of California, Berkeley. Thanks for dropping in today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
That's about all the time we have for this hour. Our music is composed by the immortal B.J. Lederman. We had help today from NPR librarian Kim Molesky. If you have missed any part of our program and like to hear it again, we got podcasts, audio, and video. You can point your laptop, your tablet, smartphone to our website at sciencefriday.com. If you like us on Facebook. We're tweeting all week. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.